"These might do for propulsion," the princess called to him. She was further up the shoreline and slightly uphill. Luke moved to stand beside her. A series of transparent selenite crystals flowed from roof to floor here. Each was taller than a man, perhaps a couple of centimeters thick. Phosphorescent growths on them gave them the look of windows in a church, and the knife-edged mineral was suffused in places with vermilion light. "They're almost too beautiful to break," Luke commented in admiration. "But you're right, they'll make good paddles." Using the invaluable saber once more, he cut loose four blades of the right size, shaped them with the blue beam for holding. Then they carried them down to the water and placed them carefully in the leprous lily they hoped would carry them across the lake. "Ready to go?" he asked finally. Leah hesitated, checked her wrist chronometer. "We've been walking for nearly 16 hours, Luke," she gestured at the lake. "If we're going to try and cross that, I'd just as soon do it on a full night's sleep." "Or day's sleep," Luke agreed. They had no way of telling whether it was day or night in the world above. He found a rotting piece of one of the pad growths, marooned on shore, and dragged it upslope. It would make an acceptable mattress. "You go ahead," he urged her as they stretched out on the soft matter. "I'm not quite tired yet." She nodded, tried to find a comfortable position on the damp cellulose. In 2 minutes, they were both sound asleep. Luke awoke with a start, sitting up fast and flicking his eyes in all directions. He thought he'd heard something moving. But there was nothing, only the steady trickle of the stream merging with the lake, and the sound of the drops falling into the lake itself from overhead. After checking his timer, he woke the princess. She rubbed sleep from her eyes, asked, "How long?" "Nearly 12 hours. I guess I was exhausted, too." They broke out fresh concentrates, munched them hungrily. Luke brought water from the stream in a collapsible cup. They ate by the transparent brook, watching water bugs swim anxiously back and forth. "I never dreamed concentrates could taste so good," the princess observed, finishing the last of one cube and downing several swallows of water. "My appetite will improve when we see sunlight again," was Luke's comment. Out of excuses, he stared at the lake. "I hope this lake's not as wide as it looks. I don't like traveling on water." "That's not surprising," soothed the princess, knowing that on the desert world of Tatooine, where Luke had been raised, an open body of water was as rare as an evergreen. Wordlessly, they slipped into the pod boat. Each took up one of the long selenite blades. Luke untied the cord from the stalagmite, recoiled it and replaced it on his belt, then pushed off. They slid out onto the lake as if greased. Luke experienced exquisite terror as they rowed out across what looked like a bottomless crater. The actual bottom could have been a mere meter beneath them, but the dark water was literally unfathomable. Like the water bugs in the stream, worries darted rapidly through Luke's mind. What if the lake ran on for hundreds of kilometers, or supposed it branched in several directions? Without the visible pathway, they could easily get lost forever. Their best chance was to hug the wall on their left, where the path had vanished into the water. It seemed unlikely that it would cut across the lake. More sensible for it to stay close to the wall, where presumably it was shallowest. He imagined unknown terrors. Perhaps a huge subterranean waterfall drained the lake, a cataract which would send them inexorably to a lonely death on rocks that had never seen the light of day. As they traveled steadily on, such imaginary terrors lost some of their immediacy. The waterfall, for example. In the excellent acoustics of the cavern, they'd heard no distant thunderous roaring. After an hour of slow, painful paddling, he discovered he no longer cared what they found at the far side of the lake, just so long as they found the far side of the lake. His upper shoulders began aching relentlessly. He knew it must be as painful, if not more so, for the princess. Yet she hadn't complained once, hadn't said a word in protest as they continued the agonizingly slow process of pushing themselves through the water. While admiring her fortitude, he wondered if the experiences they'd gone through so far in Mimban had had a mellowing effect on her. He was unable to tell, but was grateful for it nonetheless. "Why don't you rest, princess?" he counseled her firmly. "I'll row for a while." "Don't be ridiculous," she replied, gentle but firm, yet without much enthusiasm. "It would be silly for you to reach back and forth across this thing. I'm not that confident of its buoyancy as it is, and if you stay in one place, you'll just paddle us in circles." Stay where you are and save your strength. Luke acceded to common sense, which might be less attractive than gallantry, but more practical. They rested periodically. Half the day vanished monotonously without sight of the far shore. In the currentless black water, they stopped for a midday meal of colored cubes. Far, far above, Luke saw that the cavern ceiling was dominated by clusters of stalactites that dwarfed any formations they'd seen thus far. Several of them must have weighed many tons. There were also long, thin ones, dozens of meters long and no thicker than a man's thumb. All were liberally coated with the luminescent lichen fungi, which filled the enormous chamber with a comforting yellow-blue glow. As he thought back to Halla's comment on water, he grinned. She'd been right about that. It was somehow magical to dip one's cup into the blackness and watch it fill, for the lake's color was so rich and pure and solid that the blackness had to be part of the water itself. The water was purer, fresher than any Luke had ever swallowed. As they ate and drank in silence, he reflected on how much he missed the tiny stream that had guided them this far. Its steady bubbling and gurgling had been a great comfort. Now they had to settle for the intermittent and less lively pings of drops falling from the stalactites overhead. Lunch concluded, they continued on. Several hours later, an uncertain Luke put a warning hand on the princess's shoulder and motioned her to cease paddling. "What is it?" she whispered, questioning. Luke stared at the absolutely flat, unbroken lake surface. "Listen." Leah did so, studying the water nervously in the dim light. A faint plop-plop sounded. "That's just drip water from the ceiling," she husked. "No," he insisted, "it's too erratic. Drip water falls steadily." The noise ceased. "I don't hear it any more, Luke. It must have been drip water." Luke looked worriedly at the black mirror they floated on. "I can't hear it now, either." Taking up his selenite paddle, he dipped it into the water and began stroking again. Occasionally he would pause for a quick look over one shoulder or the other. So far, however, nothing lay behind them except his own fears. His nervousness communicated itself to the princess. She was beginning to relax again when he held up a hand. "Stop!" She raised her paddle clear of the water, a trifle annoyed this time. "There it is again," he announced tensely. "Don't you hear it, Leah?" She didn't reply. "Leah?" Turning, he saw that she was gazing fixedly at something in the water. Her mouth hung open, but she couldn't speak. She could point, though. Luke reached for his lightsaber instinctively, even before he spotted the trail of fat bubbles that was arrowing rapidly toward them, as ominous and threatening as any projectile. Moving carefully to the rear of the pad, Luke balanced himself on a knee and a leg, the activated saber held tightly in his right hand. The bubbles stopped, were not immediately resumed. Maybe it's gone away, the princess murmured tightly. Maybe, Luke half conceded. It rose, a pale, amorphous form shining with phosphorescence. In color, it was not unlike the great Wondrella, but compared to the lake spirit, the worm thing was a familiar creature. There was no face. Nothing recognizable in that constantly altering form. It lifted short, thick pseudopods of a whitish substance clear of the surface. They gleamed brightly in the dim cavern light. Luke thought he could see partway through the creature, and strange shapes swirling about it internally. One pulsing white arm flailed at the fragile craft. Luke swung at it with his saber. The blue beam passed through the glowing matter completely. While the saber produced no visible damage, the action caused the amoeba shape to reabsorb the limb. Another curling tentacle swiped at Luke, and this time he stabbed at it. The beam shot straight through the arm. There was no hint of blood or internal fluids of any kind. Only the lapping of water against the spongy, rocking pad and Luke's grunts as he fought frantically sounded in the chamber. For the most part, the battle proceeded in hellish silence. Each time the creature thrust at them, Luke would parry the strike with the saber. Each time the limb would shrink back into the heaving, glowing body without suffering any visible damage. A sweeping limb caught Luke from behind as he was cutting at another pseudopod. It swept him over the side as the princess screamed. Somehow he kept a hand on the upcurled rim of the pod boat. His weight caused it to tilt slightly toward him, but fortunately it was far too naturally buoyant to capsize. Leah wrestled him halfway back aboard. Then something caught him from below and yanked him beneath the surface. The princess barely let go in time to keep from being dragged over herself. Anxious moments passed with no sign of Luke. Then he broke the surface not far off, sputtering and spitting. Flaring brilliantly beneath the water, his saber swung and hacked at something unseen. It let loose long enough for him to crawl back onto the pad. The saber arced dangerously near the princess and his own legs as he cut at clinging, pale limbs. He kept cutting until the last grasping pseudopod slunk out of sight. Dripping wet and still choking on water, he knelt on the pad and tried to look every which way at once. "Look!" Leah exclaimed. Luke saw the line of bubbles in the water, only now they were moving away from the pad boat. Their steady plop-plop sounded for several minutes after the bubbles themselves had vanished from sight. Exhausted, he fell onto his back and stared at the pincushion ceiling. "You did it, Luke. You beat it off." "I'm not so sure," he panted, feeling anything but victorious. "Maybe the thing just got tired and went away." He studied the switched-off lightsaber in his fist. Or maybe it decided a saber's beams not very palatable. He reattached it to his belt, sat up with a groan, and locked his arms about his knees. Water dripped from his hair down in front of his face. Leah moved closer, reached out uncertainly to touch his arm. He eyed her, then coughed. She sat back. Suddenly she began screaming. Luke looked around, but there was nothing in sight. Bending over, the princess screamed into clasped hands. The muffled wail continued for several minutes. When it ended, she looked back up at him without apology. "I'm all right now, I think," she said with forced steadiness. She took a deep breath. "I just think I'm ready to leave this place, Luke." Her voice rose slightly. "I'm ready to get out." "Believe me, Leah," he replied, taking her hand in his, "I'm in just as big a hurry as you." They exchanged wordless thoughts. Then each picked up a paddle, and together they resumed digging black water. Despite Luke's feeling that their translucent assailant would attack again, they weren't bothered for several hours. But then it didn't matter. The far shore of the lake finally hove into view. Only there was something more than a naked shoreline coming toward them. "Surely the Cowway didn't build that," Luke whispered in awe. An ancient dock protruded from the dry ground ahead. While no boats of any kind were in sight, the long finger of metal extending out into the water left no doubt as to its function, its alien design notwithstanding. Luke had less luck identifying the purposes of the numerous structures clustered all along the shore. Many appeared raised from stone, others had metal walls, and some combinations of both materials. No matter what the composition, every one displayed signs of considerable age. Not a single edifice rose unmarred by time. Try as he might, Luke couldn't locate a single window. Openings which must have served as doors were squatly oval. They paddled for the left-hand shore until the pad thumped bottom. Stepping out into water up to his waist, Luke extended a supportive hand for the princess. She remained in the boat, not exactly frightened, but devoid of confidence. "Come on," Luke urged her. "It's not deep here." "But I'd have to step in the water. I'd rather not, Luke." "It's all right," he assured her, masking any impatience. "You can make it in a few steps." She shook her head again. Luke sighed, waded to the edge of the pad. He extended both arms. She slipped into them, and he carried her to dry land, noticing as he did so how tightly she held her eyes closed. Finally, they were sitting gratefully on the stone berm, no longer caring if their makeshift craft floated away. Behind them, the city of the Thrella loomed silently. "Okay now?" he inquired, leaning forward and looking at her face. She didn't meet his eyes. "I'm okay. I'm sorry I was so much trouble. I'm sorry I did so much screaming. I usually have better control of myself than that." "You've nothing to be sorry for," he assured her firmly. "Certainly not for screaming. As for being frightened," he smiled gently, "I was trice as terrified as you when that half-goblin came up out of the water at us. I was too busy to be screaming, or I'm sure I would have." "Oh, it wasn't the monster so much," Leah explained disarmingly. "That was a real palpable threat." She got to her feet, continued almost casually. "It's just that I can't swim." Luke sat staring at her in disbelief as she wrung water from her torn coveralls. "Why didn't you say something before we pushed off?" he finally managed to ask. She gave him a wry smile. "Would that have mattered, Luke? The trail vanished into the lake." She gestured toward the unmistakable pathway that reemerged from the water's edge nearby and wound into the subterranean city. We had to get across. It was an unfortunate but unavoidable situation. I didn't see any point in burdening you with my own childhood fears. She walked toward the pathway. Look, it goes on through the town. I'd like to meet the people who built this place. She glanced back at him impatiently. We're wasting time. Dumb with admiration, he climbed erect and followed her into the maze of structures. It rapidly became clear that the city was the product of an intelligence that had long since disappeared from Mimban. Everything was neatly laid out, and the metalwork showed signs of advanced techniques. The decay of the buildings was due to time, not shoddy design or construction. Given the relative paucity of natural erosion underground, the city had to be ancient indeed. The absence of right angles, and a preference for sweeping curves and arches, indicated that the inhabitants of the city had been aesthetically as well as architecturally talented. Beauty of design was another luxury primitive peoples could rarely afford, generally having to gear their construction strictly to the utilitarian. Something clattered softly behind them, and Luke whirled. The mystifying oval portals stared back at him like the eye sockets of gray, bleached skulls. The princess frowned at him. "But I heard something, that's all," he informed her, staring resolutely ahead. They continued on through the city, but Luke's curt disclaimer belied his uneasiness. He had heard something. As they walked along the meandering pathway and the buildings drew closer about them, he felt a crawling sensation on his neck as if someone or something was staring at him. It became an almost palpable feeling. Yet, every time he jerked around sharply for a look, there was nothing. Not a suggestion of movement, not a sigh, not a sound. He was grateful when the buildings started to thin out and become less numerous. Empty doorways beckoned to him, and he was tempted, very tempted, to enter one of the ruined structures to find out if its interior was as well preserved as the outside. This was not, he reminded himself firmly, the time for playful exploration. Their first concern was to find the way out, not to go poking through this ancient metropolis, however wonderful it was. He wondered what had caused the extinction of Mimban's advanced races, of the temple builders and the Thrella and the others. Interracial warfare, perhaps, or maybe sequential decadence ending in their being overwhelmed by aborigines like the Greenies. Rock scraped on rock. This time, when he spun, there was a hint of movement behind a wall of stalagmites off to their left. "Don't tell me you didn't hear that!" "Rocks fall from the roof constantly in caves," the princess agreed readily. "I know how you feel, Luke. I'm still pretty jumpy myself." "This wasn't my nerves," he insisted. "There's something following us. I saw it move." Ignoring the princess's protests, he started toward the ridge of colored spires. The sound wasn't repeated, and there was no movement. Walking in a half-crouch, he reached the far end of the little wall and peered around it. There was nothing there. "Luke!" Ben Kenobi would have been proud. In one smooth motion, he threw up a hand to ward off the shape falling toward him, activated and drew the lightsaber at the same time. Unknowingly, he performed both actions with the same arm. The hand he threw up defensively held the saber. The creature was quickly cut in half. Luke ran back to rejoin the princess. She was pointing ahead. Their path was blocked by two more of the bipeds. Others appeared behind them, two, three more, moving in on them cautiously. "Koway," Leah commented, bending to pick up a broken stalactite. She shifted it efficiently in her hand, held it like a dagger as the humanoid stalked them. Each was slim and covered with a fine gray down. Their eyes were shrunken dark orbs. Yet they appeared to see Luke and Princess clearly enough. Each wore a kind of abbreviated set of trousers, from which dangled a sort of primitive instruments and many charms. These were matched by others hanging from upper arms and neck. All were armed with a long, thin stone spear made of flowstone. A couple also carried double-bladed axes. They displayed no fear of Luke's lightsaber, despite its recently demonstrated lethal qualities. This indicated either a fair knowledge of human technology from surface visits, or else a bravery born of ignorance. Luckily, their tactics were equally primitive. With a rolling cry, the three behind all charged together, while the two ahead rushed in several moments late. The slight difference in time was critical. A single swipe of the saber sliced two of the thrusting spears in half. The third jabbed at the princess. She blocked the thrust with her stone, got her legs around the onrushing natives, and sent it crashing to the ground. Rolling over on top of him, she brought the stalactite section down hard on its skull. There was a plastic breaking sound, and blood gushed freely. Luke ducked a wild axe swing, cut both legs out from under the wielder. By now the two latecomers had entered the fray. Luke dispatched one with a thrust that cut off the hand holding the spear above the wrist. Its owner collapsed on the ground, moaning and holding the cauterized stump. More cautious than his companion, the second pulled up hastily. He started jabbing at Luke with his spear. Luke promptly cut off the spear point, whereupon its owner threw the shaft at Luke, spun, and ran back the way it had come. Luke turned to the princess. She was adroitly dodging the alternating cuts and jabs of the remaining native, hunting for an opening. But when the creature saw Luke approaching, it turned to retreat. Hefting the saber carefully, Luke let the weapon fly. It passed completely through the corway at the small of its back until the solid pommel contacted flesh. It fell to the ground, instantly dead. "Hurry," the princess urged, salvaging an axe from one of the fallen creatures. "It mustn't get away to warn others." Luke retrieved his saber and hurried after her. Together they ran in pursuit of the single remaining koway. In their rush, neither noticed immediately that they were traveling very slightly, but unmistakably uphill. For the first time they had abandoned the Thrella well. A huge pile of rubble fallen from the ceiling lay ahead. The fleeing koway reached it, started scrambling for the top. While still on the run, the princess took aim and heaved the axe she carried with more force and accuracy than Luke or anyone else would have given her credit for. It struck the native on the right shoulder and sent it tumbling down the other side of the rock pile. "You got him," Luke exclaimed. "You got him." Gasping for breath, they started up the hill of broken stone. It seemed brighter on the far side, probably, Luke mused absently, from denser growth of light-generating plants. Mimbanian botany was otherwise far from his thoughts now. They had to catch and dispatch the wounded koway before it brought an army of its fellows down on them. They topped the rise, and paused there at the sight of what lay just beyond. Chapter 10, page 154. The cave opened out into an enormous circular amphitheater, as large as the Black Lake, only empty of water. High up on the far side of the cavern wall sat several small, single-story structures. They were of the same construction as the city just behind them, perhaps some kind of gateway buildings. Only these were not nearly as run down as the structures in the main part of the city. Someone had kept them reasonably intact. The ground around them had been cleared of debris, and walls and roofs were neatly, if crudely, patched. They gave every sign of being occupied. Below they saw the native the princess had nicked with the axe, holding his shoulder as he ran toward a great crowd of furred beings clustered in the cavern center. They stood around a modest pond, a depression kept full by seepage from the ceiling. A real bonfire blazed to the pond's left, fed by assorted yellow-brown substances, which were not honest wood, but which burned very efficiently. Framed by the pond and fire were three large stalagmites, to which were tied two growling yuzzum and an old woman. Halla stood bound by several vine-like cords, while Hin and Key were nearly mummified by many more. 3PO and R2-D2 stood enveloped in vine cords nearby. At least 200 koway, including armed females and children, clustered around pond, fire, and prisoners. The wounded relative running toward them was now yelling at the top of his lungs. Luke started to turn. The princess grabbed his arm, stared hard at him. "Where would we run to, Luke? They'll be after us in seconds, and they know these passages. If we have to fight and die, I'd rather do it out in the open, and not on the lake." She hefted the fallen axe. "Leah, we..." But she was already scrambling down the rubble toward the cavern. By this time the injured koway had reached the crowd and was jabbering excitedly to several large males who wore unmistakable headdresses of stone, bone, and other materials. Several cries came from backward-looking members of the assembly. All eyes shifted to the two beings walking slowly toward them. Luke held his lightsaber before him. The native Leah had wounded now pointed to the glowing weapon and muttered nervously. As they neared the mob of assembled troglodytes, Luke made what he had hoped was a positive, confident gesture with the saber. The crowd, muttering uncertainly, parted. Twitching internally, Luke and the princess marched between the ranks of intent natives toward the three captives. While they respected the power of the lightsaber, Luke had the distinct impression they were anything but panicked by it. "They're not sure what to do," the princess murmured, confirming his own thoughts. "They seem to admire your saber, but they're not going to grant you godhood." "They'll admire it more if they try and stop us," Luke said grimly, with increasing confidence. He gestured sharply at one knot of Koways, which were pressing a little close. "Luke!" Halal yelped as the two drew near the captives. Both Yuzum were chattering gleefully at Luke and to one another. "Well, you met us," he observed sardonically as he studied their bonds. "You were right about that, too, Halla." "Not quite the way I intended, boy," she shouted something to the three splendidly attired natives the wounded one had approached, then resumed whispering to Luke. "You realize we haven't much chance of getting out of here?" "She's right, sir," said 3PO. "Try to save yourselves. I didn't walk and row this far to end up sacrificed to some subterranean deity," he shot back. Abruptly, he realized what had just happened. "You can talk to them?" he stated in surprise. "A little. Their language is a variant of the one the greenies use. It's not easy, sort of like talking underwater, but I can make the chiefs understand me." "Chiefs?" "It seems Koway tribes are ruled by a triumvirate," she explained. "Those three laughing boys in the bonnets over there. I just made them a proposal. If they're as noble or sporting as I think they are, we might have one chance." "Proposal? What proposal?" the princess inquired suspiciously. "I'll get to that shortly," Halla told her evasively. "We'd located the way down and were on our way to meet you when we were ambushed. It was in a narrow passageway, and in close quarters there were just too many of them. They used nets on your Yuzum and droid friends, boy. We didn't have a chance." "We might if I set you free now," Luke theorized. "Where are your weapons?" "Take it easy, Luke," she admonished him. She jerked her head in the direction of the cluster of low-lying buildings far off on the right side of the cavern. "You'd never make it over there. Besides, I didn't see which house they put them in." "Even if I knew exactly, you'd never be able to cut us free, get to them, and get back in time. You're pretty good with that lightsaber, I expect, but you can't fight 100 spears all flying at you from different directions at once. Unless," she brightened hopefully, "that toy of yours generates a screen as well as a blade." "No," Luke confessed, "just the blade." "How long have you been tied here?" "About half a day, and my bladder's killing me," she informed him. "They spent the time arguing about which way to go about killing us. They don't have any personal grudge against us. They just don't like humans generally. Not surprising if they've been able to observe how the miners treat the greenies. I don't think our Koway friends would be too upset if every human on Mimban suddenly picked up and left." "Tell them we're not like the local humans," Luke insisted, eyeing the circle of hostile faces. "Tell them that we don't want anything to do with the local people, either." "This isn't a tribe of philosophers, Luke boy," Halladick explained patiently. "Their concept of government is damned simple. You can't explain something like the rebellion to the Koway. But I think," she added, peering past Luke at the three chiefs, who were still engaged in heated discussion among themselves, "they'll give us one chance." "I don't believe it," the princess countered, glowering at the old woman. "Would we give an enemy who'd already killed four of our own a second chance?" "According to the fellow with the gash in his shoulder who preceded you here," Halla went on, "you only killed two. The others are just wounded. Apparently the Koway treat death as an inevitable everyday occurrence. Primitive society, remember? To their way of thinking, the two you killed simply died a little earlier than they should have. One chief even berated the dead men just now for making a poor decision. Says they ought to have waited for reinforcements. He's arguing that the blame isn't yours, it's the dead ones, for acting stupid when they should have known better." "That's barbaric," the princess muttered. Halla looked smug. "What have I been telling you all along? Anyway, the one with the shoulder you sliced, Luke, is telling—" "Not him," objected the princess. "Me." "Oh?" Halla's estimate of the princess rose a notch. "Well, he's been ranting on about what a great fighter Luke is." Luke looked distressed at this admiration of an action he'd despised. "A lightsaber against spears and axes isn't a very fair fight." Halla nodded agreeably. "That's what they're arguing about now." "I'm not sure I follow you, Halla." "I tried to tell them everything, Luke boy," she explained, "when you and the girl were climbing down this side of the rockfall. I tried to convince them that not only were we from off-planet and of different variety from the miners, but that you were both fighting the humans on the surface, and that if we won, you'd kick them all off Mimban. Then the Koway could go back to roaming the surface whenever they pleased. One chief is all for it, the second thinks I'm the biggest liar in the history of their race, and the third is undecided. That's what all the noise is about. The first two are each trying to persuade the third to take his side. What about this proposal? The princess wanted to know. Oh, that, Halla managed to look embarrassed. I suggested that if they couldn't make up their minds as to what the truth was, they could let Kanu decide. As near as I can figure, Kanu's the local god in charge of adjudicating. All their greatest warrior has to do to convince Kanu that we're telling the truth is to defeat one of their tribal champions. Luke blinked. Give me that again, Halla? Don't worry, Halla assured him. You have the force on your side, remember? Force? I'd rather have my saber. She shook her head apologetically. Sorry, Luke boy, you said it yourself. Axes and spears against a saber's not fair. Luke turned away, looked discouraged. I'm no fighter, Halla, and you overestimate the force's usefulness. Luke, these people are no giants. They're not midgets either. What happens if we agree to this contest and I happen to lose? Halla's answer was delivered with her usual aplomb. Then we'll likely have our throats cut in some uniquely primitive manner. He kicked angrily at the ground. Please, Luke, I tried my best. It's our only possibility. They wouldn't agree to fight one of the Yuzum. They don't think of them as intelligent. Either that or they're not as primitive as you think, declared the princess. It's not that so much, child, as the fact that it's we humans who are exploiting the surface. So we're the ones who have to prove ourselves before Kanu. Further discussion was forestalled when the three chiefs abruptly broke off their conversation. One of them, Luke couldn't tell them apart, turned and called something out to Halla. She listened intently, then grinned. It's on. They're willing to abide by Kanu's judgment. She turned a concerned gaze to Luke. I'm an old woman, boy, but like I've told you, I still have a lot of living planned. Don't let me down. You must win, Luke, the princess said. If I don't attend that meeting of the underground on Sir Carpus eventually, our absence is likely to keep them from ever considering joining the Alliance. Luke's eyes moved from Halla to Leah. The Alliance? What about me? Don't let you down? Both of you listen. He tapped his chest and regarded Leah. It's more important in the end that I go on living than it is for me to make some vague patriotic sacrifice. Or, he continued facing Halla, that I get you out of a jam that you should have been able to avoid. You're the one with all the Mimbanian experience. Luke, boy, she started to argue. He shut her up with a wave. Not now, it doesn't matter any more. He handed the lightsaber to the princess. All right, what are the rules, and who do I fight? Let's finish this one way or the other. You fight, Halla translated laboriously, listening to the chief's words, until one of you quits or dies. The word for quit is sane. It doesn't matter, since you've nothing to gain by saying it. Luke merely grunted, walked toward the chiefs. The entire crowd was babbling now, apparently in anticipation of the imminent battle. Luke found that despite the coolness, he was beginning to sweat. The crowd parted, and Luke had his first glimpse of the Koway he apparently was going to fight. Some of the tenseness left him. Though broader than he was, the creature was the same height. He didn't appear especially ferocious, either. There were larger Koways in the crowd, and more fearsome-looking ones. Yet this modest-appearing specimen was the chosen champion. There had to be a reason, which he was sure to discover sooner than he wished. He examined his opponent guardedly. For its part, the Koway stared back, gave him a profound bow, and made an intricate movement with both arms. Unable to duplicate the complex ritual, Luke gave the Alliance salute. What sounded like a murmur of approval issued from the crowd. It might also have been their way of saying that he was going to be torn to small, furless bits, but he preferred to believe the other. The Koway walked past him, stopped on the far side of the pond. What do I do now? Luke wondered, calling back to Halla. Walk to this side of the pond and face him, he was told. When the second chief, that one in the middle with the blue spine sticking out of his collar, drops his right arm, the two of you go after each other. Her voice held no humor now. Do we have to fight in the water? He inquired worriedly. No one said so. That's good enough for me. A singularly chilling howl came from the crowd. It was followed by dead silence. The middle chief raised its arm, dropped it with a swipe. Immediately the Kowei started across the pond toward Luke. Luke prowled his side of the water, trying to decide what to try. Should he strike at the head or body? It was impossible to detect any obvious vulnerable spot under that gray carpet of fur. Shouts from the onlookers thundered around the cavern walls. "Why did you bother to tell Luke the word for quitting?" the princess whispered to Hala, "if he can't gain anything by using it." "I'm hoping he'll get in a tight spot and use it as a last resort," Hala whispered back. "But why?" "Because it's not the Kowei term for quitting. It's a local swear word. Has something to do with parentage, I think." Whirling, the princess gave her a shocked look. "In Alliance's cause? Why did you do that, old woman?" "I thought it might do us some good if Luke yells something defiant while that brute is choking the life out of him. We're nothing to lose by it. Luke doesn't either. The Kowei admire spirit." The princess was too shocked and disgusted to reply. Her obvious feelings had no effect on Hala. She was staring past her toward the pond. "If we're lucky, he'll never have to utter it," she said blithely. "In any case, there's nothing we can do about it now." Luke jumped around the edge of the water, trying to get some estimate of his rival's mobility. Either his opponent was too clever to respond, or more likely he just didn't care. The Kowei headed relentlessly straight for Luke, splashing and kicking up water in a fine display of indifference to anything Luke chose to do. As far as Luke was concerned, the Kowei was far too enthusiastic about this contest. Its actions bespoke an assurance Luke couldn't begin to share. If he remained where he was, Luke reflected frantically, the Kowei would have to come upslope out of the water after him. It would give the worried youth a slight technical advantage. So he stopped moving around, checked his footing, and waited. Arms outstretched for an unaffectionate embrace, the Kowei charged. Luke met directness with directness. As soon as the creature was close, he threw his best punch straight at the onrushing jaw. Maybe the Kowei had glass chins. As it turned out, the metaphor was inappropriate. The Kowei's lower jaw was made of solid granite, not glass. Even so, the force of Luke's blow stopped it for a second. When it came on him again, Luke jabbed with his other fist at where the solar plexus would have been in a human. It didn't even slow the Kowei. Luke tried to duck and roll under an outstretched arm, but the aborigine was startlingly quick. It grabbed Luke's shoulder and spun him around. Luke desperately tried to backpedal, found himself in water. The pond bottom was slippery, and he fell backward, landing with a splash. As the Kowei threw himself at him, he twisted in fear and found himself on top of his opponent. With both hands, he tried to force the furry head beneath the water. It wouldn't budge. It was rapidly growing clear to Luke why the Kowei had selected this slightly smaller version of themselves as their representative to Kanu's court. He was lithe and agile, and one big piece of muscle under all that deceptively soft-looking fuzz. No other rules, he reminded himself. With one hand, he hunted hopefully along the slick pond bottom for a rock, for anything solid and smaller than his fist. He encountered only sand, and all the probing unbalanced him. The Kowei threw him off and fell on his chest. Unlike the native, Luke found his head easily forced under the surface. A few centimeters of water served to turn the roars of the crowd to a muffled echo. He stared upward. Distorted by the water, the batrachian face of the Kowei glared down at him. Inexorable pressure held him under with one hand as the native balanced itself with the other. Desperately, Luke turned to the right. His mouth bumped against something warm, and he bit down hard. With a jerk, the Kowei pulled its injured member away. Luke's head broke water, and he swallowed air gratefully. Like another opponent, the crowd noise assailed him again. Through it he could hear Hala and Leah and Threepio screaming frantic encouragement. Both Yuzum were hooting deafeningly, while R2 beeped and whistled loud enough to drown out half the Kowei's. If only Hin were in his place. The Kowei above him wouldn't be grinning so easily. As the hand he had bitten returned and tried to get a fresh grip on his skull, Luke twisted violently and probed with both hands. Fingers searched the creature's flanks, hunting for anything sensitive. Most of the regions Luke wanted to try were out of reach, however. Impatient, the Kowei brought its other hand over to steady Luke's head so that the right hand could get a firm grip on it. Thus balanced, Luke discovered the water working to his advantage. He heaved and spun. The teetering native went over sideways into the pond. Thoroughly soaked and half-drowned, Luke staggered to his feet. He eyed the koway as it rose again, tried to think of something to attack next. Meanwhile, the native lowered its shoulders and charged. This time, Luke used his right leg. As the youth put every ounce of his remaining strength into the kick, his foot fairly exploded out of the water. It caught the koway in the midsection, roughly where a human stomach would be located. Whether from the tremendous force of the kick or the fact that he had struck a more vulnerable area, the koway let out a startled woof and sat down hard in the water. Stumbling toward it, Luke lifted his leg and kicked again. The koway wasn't so stunned it failed to raise an arm to block the kick. Simultaneously, it grabbed the swinging leg and fell across it. Luke tried to turn over as the still-sitting koway pulled him toward itself by the one thrashing leg. If the creature could get its hands on him this time, Luke knew the matter would be ended. He was face down on the sand. There would be nothing he could do. His dragging hands encountered something oblong and unyielding. A rock, but too large for him to get a hand around. He needed both hands to raise anything so massive, and much better leverage than he possessed at the moment to make use of it. The hand he feared came down on the back of his neck. It shoved downward brutally hard, so hard that Luke's face plunged into the sandy bottom of the pond. He felt the clean grains pressing into his nostrils. Raised on a desert world, he was about to meet a death damper than any he had ever conceived of. His thoughts became hazy as his blood scoured the last dregs of oxygen from his lungs. A voice sang fancifully in the back of his mind. It was exhorting him to relax. Well, that was simple enough to do, he reflected pleasantly. Relax he would. He was tired, so tired now. The koway took it for a ploy and didn't ease the pressure on Luke. If anything, it shoved harder, sensing victory. Then, miraculously, the pressure vanished from Luke's neck. Unable to think of turning to defend himself or of striking back, Luke shot to the surface. Air, most delicious of gases, it filled his starved lungs, those weakened bellows pumping harder with every fresh breath. Coughing up water, he stayed on his knees, delirious with the pleasure of being able to breathe again. Only when his system's panicky requests for oxygen faded did he think to turn and look for his opponent. Blood trickled from the side of the koway's head into the clear pond water. It was lying on its back, manifestly unconscious, maybe dead. On hands and knees, a thoroughly dazed and somewhat puzzled Luke crawled to the koway's motionless size. With one hand he touched the other's face, raised a fist over it, but there was no movement. The koway's distress was genuine and not some cat-and-mouse alien ploy. It did not rise to attack. Another body was suddenly in the water beside him. "You won, Luke! You beat him!" the princess was shouting into his ear. She had both arms wrapped tightly around him, and the pressure almost sent them both tumbling together into the water. "Don't you understand?" she asked brightly. "You won! We can all go free now." "That is," she continued in a more subdued voice, staring around at the silent crowd and trying not to show any fear. "We can, if these creatures have any sense of honor." "I wouldn't worry too much about that, Leah," he advised her, wiping water from his face. "Canu has judged, remember? Besides, it takes many thousands of years of advanced technological development for a society to reduce honor to an abstract moral truism devoid of real meaning." "If this were an imperial arena, then I'd be concerned," he regarded the watching natives. "I think the koway keep their word." "We'll find out," she assured him, wishing she could share his certainty. Putting his left arm around her shoulders, she helped him to his feet. As they started out of the pond, Luke heard something burbling and snorting like a hog in heat. A glance to his left showed the twitching form of his opponent. He was gratified. The koway wasn't dead. As soon as this became apparent, several koway broke from the assembled ranks and approached their injured relative. For a moment, Luke felt concern. He had heard of primitive societies where the vanquished or dishonored representative of a tribe was put to death for his or her failure. It looked as if the koway were more mature than that. They lifted their defeated champion to a sitting position and held some kind of burning plant under his face. Luke caught a whiff of it, and it helped him regain his strength. He tried to hurry past. Even if the koway was dead, he decided only half-jokingly, one breath of that incredibly pungent burning substance would have aroused him. Then something caught his eye, and he paused, staring blankly at it. What had riveted his attention was not the Kowei's continuing methods of medication, nor the vanquished warrior's convulsive reactions to them, but a large rock, as big as a man's head. It lay in the water close by the Kowei's head. His fingertips retained the memory of that stone. It was the one he'd encountered prior to passing out. Or had he passed out? It seemed as if something deep inside him, some resource of which he was unaware, had reacted on the brink of asphyxiation to help him raise the rock, turn and fling it at his tormentor. Yet he couldn't recall even placing both hands around it, let alone lifting it clear of the water and throwing. "How did I do it?" he asked the princess. She eyed him uncertainly. Do what? Beat him, he added exhaustedly, gesturing loosely toward the Kowei fighter. Her gaze traveling from the native back to Luke, the princess permitted herself a frown. You mean you don't remember? He shook his head. I thought everything was finished when you were pushed under the second time, Luke. I suppose I was worrying needlessly, but by staying under so long you had us all fooled. I wasn't fooling, Luke said to himself. The princess was smiling now. Then you threw that big rock, caught him right in the temple. The creature wasn't expecting it. He didn't even try to duck. I didn't think you were that supple an in-fighter, Luke. Luke could have objected, could have mentioned that he wasn't expecting it either. Only the obvious admiration shining from the princess's eyes kept him silent. They could discuss all that later, he argued with himself. But one thing seemed unarguable. Somehow he had thrown the rock. By one method or another, he'd thrown it. That was the important thing. Now to find out if his evaluation of the Kowei would make his mysterious effort worthwhile. They reached Halla and the others. All were trying to congratulate him at once. Luke didn't reply. Retrieving his saber from the princess, he utilized it on low power to cut away the vines tying old Halla to the stalactites. The old woman nearly fell, momentarily incapacitated by lack of circulation to her bound legs. The princess was there to steady her. Thank you, young lady. Halla bent over and rubbed her thighs. Luke moved to release the Yuzum and the droids. As he did so, one of the three chiefs, the one whose signal had initiated the fight, interposed itself between Luke and Key. For an awful moment, Luke felt he'd completely misjudged the Kowei, that he'd taken a romantic instead of realistic view of them. Was he going to have to fight again? Or possibly the Yuzum, not being human, would have to perform some difficult feat of their own to regain their freedom? What unimaginable facet of subterranean law did they face now? He needn't have troubled himself. The chief merely wished to illustrate Kanu's judgment in a fashion clear to all. Luke watched tensely as the native slipped a sharp-bladed knife of volcanic glass from his garments, relaxed when the blade was used to slice away first the Yuzum restraints and then the droids. His relief faded when he heard a muttering sound and turned to see several Kowei leading toward him the one he had fought. One supported the bandaged native at each arm. The champion shook off the pair of helpers as he neared Luke. Muscles tight, Luke gripped the lightsaber firmly and waited. He chittered ominously, but Luke put up a hand to quiet the Yuzum. Reaching with both arms, the Kowei warrior clasped Luke around the shoulders and pulled. Luke thought he'd have to use the saber after all when the native pushed him away gently. Then it slapped him on one cheek. Luke blinked. The blow had been nearly powerful enough to knock him out. The Kowei murmured something, but somehow it didn't sound like a challenge. Don't just stand there, an amused Halla instructed him. Hit him back. What? Luke was confused and not ashamed to show it. I thought the fight was over. It is, she explained. It's his way of acknowledging that you're the stronger. Go on, hit him back. Well, using his right hand, he belted the quiescent Kowei hard enough to rattle the native's teeth. Despite Halla's assurances, he braced himself for some sort of violent response. Instead, the native displayed a satisfied expression and dropped to his knees before Luke as the crowd howled its approval. After the warrior had moved to one side, a second chief drew close. It spoke solemnly, directing its words toward Luke. As near as I can figure him, Halla translated softly, we're invited to stay for a feast tonight. How can they tell tonight from today? The princess wanted to know. Probably they post watchers at their exits on the surface, the old woman surmised. If they haven't always been underground dwellers, it's likely they'd retain surface methods of telling time. "Can't you refuse for us?" Luke asked hopefully. "Tell them how badly we have to return to the world above." Hala muttered something at the chief, who replied readily, "This isn't exactly a request, Luke. If we were to turn down the invitation, would apparently insult not only their hospitality, but Kanu's as well. We have our choice, of course. If we insist on refusing, all we have to do is pick a champion to fight one of theirs, and then..." Luke interrupted with, "It's just occurred to me how hungry I am." Chapter 11, page 170. They had no sense of night. When the time for the celebration finally arrived, it was as bright in the huge cavern as ever. The phosphorescent plant life of the internal membrane functioned according to schedules that ignored the unseen motions of astronomical bodies. Having dried his clothes by the permanent bonfire and then dressed again, Luke felt almost himself. Only his neck still bothered him. It ached at the back, where the Kowei's unyielding fingers had pressed. Large platters of exotic-looking foods were passed around a series of concentric circles around the pond. The visitors were entertained by endless dancing, made tolerable in spite of the wailing, rhythmic music by the truly astonishing leaps and jumps of the spring-muscled Kowei performers. Hala pronounced judgment on each platter, indicating which foods were tolerable to the human organism and which were not. What went for man apparently served Yuzum kind as well, though they did encounter a couple of stomach-twisting exceptions, none fatal. Luke ate with good grace. He considered Hala's evaluations severely deficient in a few instances, but he consumed enough food to please their anxious hosts and kept it all down. While much of it tasted like reprocessed X-wing fuselage installation, a couple of the subterranean gourmet delights were downright flavorful. He tried to concentrate on these. In actuality, he ate a great deal more than he intended to. However alien their origin, the dishes set before him were fresh. They were a welcome change from the steady diet of concentrates he and Leah had been subsisting on. For her part, the princess, seated on his immediate left, appeared to be enjoying the entertainment considerably. Apparently her feelings toward Mimban's surface didn't extend to criticism of its arts. An inquiry produced a surprising response. "That's one of the things that's so wrong with the Empire, Luke," she commented enthusiastically. "Its art has grown as decadent as the government. Both suffer from a lack of creative vitality. That's what originally drew me to the Alliance, not politics. Politically, I was probably almost as naive as you." "I don't quite see," he said dryly. "When I was living in my father's palace, I was utterly bored, Luke. Examination of why I found nothing entertaining led me to discover how the Empire had stifled any original thought. Long-established totalitarian governments fear any kind of free expression. A sculpture can be a manifesto. A manuscripted adventure can double as a cry for rebellion. From corrupt aesthetics to corrupt politics was a smaller step than most people around me realized." Luke nodded, hoping he really understood. He wanted to, since what the princess had just said was obviously very important to her. From the platter nearest him he chose a small fruit resembling a miniature pink gourd. He bit into it experimentally. Blue juice gushed all over his front, eliciting immediate laughter from Hala and the princess. No, he reflected, he probably never would completely understand the princess. "What do you expect?" he mumbled, laughing at himself, "from an untutored country boy." "I think," the princess responded softly, not looking at him, "that for an untutored country boy, you're one of the most sophisticated men I know." Primitive music and chanting faded into the background as he turned to her in surprise. Like a missile launcher sighting on its prey, his eyes contacted hers. There was a brief, silent explosion before she looked hurriedly away. Thinking very hard about something he'd hardly dared think about for several years, he bit into the fruit again, more carefully this time. Suddenly, his hand opened as if he'd been shot. The pink bulb fell to the ground as Luke stood bolt upright, eyes open and staring. The princess rose, tried to make something of the gaping expression on his face. "Luke, what's wrong?" He took a couple of unsteady steps. "Was it the fruit, boy?" Hala looked equally concerned. "Boy?" Luke blinked, turned slowly to face them all. "What?" "We were worried, Master Luke. You..." But 3PO broke off as Luke turned away to stare eastward. "He's coming," he murmured, every letter resounding. "He's near, very near." Luke, boy, you'd better start making some sense, or I'll have Hin hold you down and feed you dye pills, Hallis said. Who's coming? There was a stirring, Luke whispered by way of reply, a profound disturbance in the force. I felt it before, weakly. I felt it most strongly when Ben Kenobi was killed. Leia inhaled in terror, her eyes widening. No, not him again, not here. Something blacker than night stirs the force, Leia, Luke told her. This Governor Asada must have contacted him, sent him here. He'd be especially interested in locating you and me. Who would? Hala half shouted in frustration. Lord Darth Vader, Leia mumbled, barely audible. A dark lord of the Sith. We've met him before. Her hands were trembling. She fought to still them. A shouting native voice broke the brief moment of desolate contemplation. The music ceased. The dancers halted their gravity-defying leaps and pirouettes. All three chiefs rose and stared at the native running toward the assembly. The runner collapsed in the arms of one chief. A short, mostly one-sided conversation followed. Then the chief left the courier gasping on hands and knees, turned and gesticulated wildly as he relayed the courier's information to his people. Consternation replaced joy among the Garrett Coway. Soon the orderly assembly had become a riot, natives rushing in every direction, hairy arms flying, eyes bulging in panic. Food, utensils, instruments were forgotten, were trampled or overturned. Then the chief approached the non-Coway celebrants, shattered at Hala. What did he say? She turned to Luke and the others. Humans are coming, hard-shell humans, down the main passage from the surface, the way we came in. She looked disgusted, angry. Many humans carrying rods of death. They've already killed two Koway who were gathering food near the exit and tried to run from them. Imperial troops in armor, Luke murmured with satisfaction. It has to be, given the other presence I sensed. But how could Vader have found us down here? The princess demanded to know. How? Luke was listening to something none of the others could hear, so she turned to Hala. Could our trail in the swamp crawler have been followed? Hala considered the impossible situation reluctantly. Possible, but I doubt it. There were a lot of places where we just about floated across bog and couldn't have left a trail. But it's conceivable a top tracker could have plotted a rough course through the surface, making use of the traces we did leave. It seems incredible, though. I know all the Imperial terrain tracers, and none of them are that good. Even if one of them were, the princess rushed on, how could they go from the ruined crawler to the exit for the Koway cavern? How could they know we're down here? Maybe they thought that after our crawler was destroyed, we'd seek shelter underground, Hala hypothesized. But I still don't understand how they know we'd be in this particular cave. I guess I'm probably the cause of that. They all turned to face Luke. Just as I sensed Vader, he no doubt can sense me. He's had a lot more experience with the Force than I have, so his senses are probably stronger. Don't forget he was a pupil of Obi-Wan Kenobi. He glanced back toward the shaft tunnel leading to the surface of Mimban. He's coming for us. It was not possible for a droid to faint, but C-3PO managed a convincing imitation. R2 chided his companion. R2's right, 3PO, said Luke. Turning yourself off won't help anyone. I know that, sir, the tall droid responded, but a dark lord coming here. The very thought is enough to make my sensors go to overload. Luke smiled grimly. Mine too, 3PO. The two other chiefs joined a third member of the Koway triumvirate, started babbling at it. Their chatter was punctuated by innumerable gestures and much waving of hands. Luke had the impression many of the gestures and a good deal of the talk concerned the three humans standing nearby. Finally, the chiefs turned and stared expectantly at Luke. Baffled, he looked to Hala for an explanation. He didn't like much the one she gave him. They say that since you defeated their champion, you are the greatest warrior present. I was lucky, Luke told her honestly. They don't understand luck, Hala replied, only results. Luke shifted from one position to another. The unswerving stares of the three chiefs were making him acutely uncomfortable. Well, what do they expect me to do? They're not thinking of fighting, are they? Axes and spears against power rifles? The differences may be great technologically, the princess countered, eyeing him hard, but I wouldn't sell these people short anywhere else. They caught two full-grown Yuuzhan without any sophisticated devices. I doubt a group of humans could have done better. And they know these passageways and tunnels, Luke. They know where the sinkholes are as opposed to solid ground. The Force isn't a geological phenomenon. Maybe we have a chance. The Koh-Way'd be better off negotiating, Luke mumbled unconvinced. Sorry, Luke boy, Halla apologized, after a brief exchange with one of the chiefs. An invasion in force is different from a couple of wanderers showing up. They want a fight. Kanu, she smiled, will judge. I wish I had your confidence in aboriginal jurisprudence, Halla. Don't fight it, boy. Old Kanu did okay by you, didn't he? Luke, the princess pleaded, we have no place to run to. You just said so yourself. If Vader knows you're here, then he probably knows I'm with you. He won't stop until he... She hesitated, cleared her throat, and went on. He won't stop, Luke, even if he has to follow us to the center of Mimban. You know that. We've no choice. We have to fight.